Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mehler here, and we start the show today by talking with you about the book titled The Indian Mounds of the Horicon Marsh and Upper Rock River. And we have the two authors with us. One, Kurt Sampson, certified archaeologist, director and curator at the Dodge County Historical Society in Beaver Dam. Kurt, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And the other has been with us a number of times, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years he's written a number of books and has led many birdwatching tours, but he got involved in this book and is a co-author. Bill, good to have you back with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Always a pleasure to be here.
So as we talk with these two guys, I hope you'll join in. Let us know about the Native American mounds, perhaps, that you've seen around the state. What do you know about the history of prehistoric peoples in Wisconsin? The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And I can tell you, it's a dandy book, very complete, and I've enjoyed going through it. I can tell you, I haven't read all 500 or so pages of the book.
We are disappointed.
There's a lot there. And I guess if we talked about the genesis of this book, it would take us practically the whole show, I think, because it's been a long time coming. But how did you guys meet and then decide to write this book together?
Well, when I started at Horicon Marsh, and of course, you know, I've always been on the show to talk about birds. You know, my background is as a wildlife ecologist, and I'm pretty good at plants and glacial geology, but I knew nothing about archaeology. And I, as the naturalist at Horicon, I figured I should probably know at least something. So if I couldn't answer questions, I could at least direct people, because I knew there was a very broad audience with a lot more knowledge on different things than myself. A colleague that I worked with had suggested to me, he said, you know, there's someone in the area, a fellow by the name of Bill Bame, who does annual Indian mountain tours. He says, you know, there's quite a few mounds around Horicon Marsh. So that was my introduction. I jumped on the bus tours, learned about them, got my introduction. And Bill had always taken little excerpts from some of the research papers and surveys that had been done around the area and made little booklets and pamphlets. And after a few years, I told him, I said, you know, all this stuff is from some pretty obscure sources. Did you ever think of compiling it all together into one source? And we actually met with Bill last summer. He says, I remember that. That was a good idea, but it was not my specialty. I couldn't do it myself, and he didn't have the time, so the idea sat. So that was an idea literally 30 years ago that came into my mind. I'd made a couple of other attempts at it. And then in 2008 is when Kurt got his job at Beaver Dam at the Historical Society. And he came to the Rock River Archaeological Society meetings, which was a group I had organized around Horicon Marsh. And I remember him saying, wow, there's so many mounds in this area, and there's not much really about this. And that was certainly his expertise and background. And that's when I first approached him. I said, I've had this idea in my head, and I need an expert to do this. So that was 2008. He was busy with his job. I had things going. I was in no position to start at that time. And after my retirement, I started some other books. I wanted to start with some easier things first. And then about 3 years ago, I told Kurt, I said, you know, this has been on my mind for well over 25 years. We're either going to take this as the next project and do it, or I've got to just let this go once and for all.
Sure.
And interestingly, when I pulled up stuff that I had already transcribed and worked on, I remember telling Kurt, I go, I've got a lot of stuff here. I forgot all this is already here. I bet you 4 to 6 months, we'll bang this thing out. It took 3 more years. But it just kept growing because of his thorough research and the resources he brought to it. So it's a much more comprehensive book than I ever envisioned. And
well,
I thank Kurt for that.
It's really a dandy book. Let's start with a basic. What is an Indian mound? I think we have a general. Everybody has a sort of a general idea.
Well, an Indian mound is a burial of ancient people. In Wisconsin, they start building burial mounds somewhere right around 800 to 500 BC, and they start off with the dome shape. Round conical burial mounds. In a short time after that, maybe a couple hundred years, they started incorporating the short linear cigar-shaped mounds. And they do that for about 1,000 years. And then when we get into what's called archaeologically the late woodland period in Wisconsin prehistory, which begins roughly right around 400 or 500 AD, they start to incorporate the effigy mounds. And effigy basically means in the shape of something. So they start building burial mounds by a basket load of dirt in the shape of animals, bears and birds, things that are important to their cosmological belief system.
And geese. And other animals as well, Bill.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's interesting. It was something I didn't realize. And this was really based on the work by the current, the new state archaeologist, Amy Roseborough, who did a PhD thesis with an overview of effigy mounds in Wisconsin and an analysis of it. Goose mounds are only known from Horicon Marsh to the Four Lakes area of Madison. So, and that's, of course, a flyway right there. Nobody else did them anywhere else. These were the specific bird mound, but it makes sense. You know, this is really the waterfowl flyway. And we also find that the goose mounds in the Horicon area have straight or slightly curved wings. Here in the Madison area, they've got bent wings. So there's a little bit of a different regional interpretation of it. And as Kurt had informed me, we used to refer to this as the effigy mound builders, as if it was one whole uniform group of people who made this all across the state. It turns out there are very specific regional differences, and they refer to it now as the burial mound ceremonial complex. Everybody was doing it, but little local groups had their own interpretation and style. And Dodge County certainly has a very unique collection of mounds that are not represented in the rest of the state. And by the way, 98% of all the effigy mounds in the world are in Wisconsin. This is our archetype.
Wow. Well, I just want to get it out of the way about the title. You refer to these formations as Indian mounds, not Native American mounds. And what's the reasoning on that?
Well, first of all, Indian mounds is really in common use among archaeologists. A book that came out before us is called Indian Mounds of Wisconsin by Bob Birmingham. And in that book, he actually explains it. We quote him in this, that it is the common usage of it. The people themselves, out of respect, certainly we refer to them as Native Americans, but this has been a common use of Indian mounds. It's always been used that way, and we decided to stick with that because it seems to be the most commonly used terminology for it. So no disrespect for the people themselves, but these are the prehistoric works that preceded the modern Native Americans.
What and the book itself, I think we should give our listeners an idea of what's all included in the book, because you really got, you've got history. There's a lot in there.
Well, you know, we started off first and foremost by trying to figure out how many mound sites were in the county and where those were located. So we document that first and foremost. But we also document in short biographies people like Increase Lapham, who started doing the first mound mapping in Wisconsin and produced the classic Antiquities of Wisconsin as Surveyed and Scribed in 1855. And there is also another well-known, well, in the archaeological literature, mound surveyor named Theodore Lewis, who was out of the Minneapolis area. And he came into Dodge County in the 1890s and documented many mounds. And then there's also a not-so-well-known mound mapper named Edgar Bruder, who was actually a dentist and a naval officer in the 1950s, who got generally interested in mounds and started documenting them. So we highlight those biographies. But the book, you know, we wanted to try to incorporate a Native voice into the book and actually put, you know, the inferences about the meaning of mounds come from many different avenues. It comes from the archaeological excavations, comes from studying ethnographies and talking to the Native American people themselves and what they're actually saying about the mounds. So we wanted to make sure that we included that voice into the book as well. So the book is really full of a lot of Native American myths, legends, and interpretations from that standpoint. And what else was there, Bill?
Well, the real guts of the book is a compilation of all known surveys, any writing that was ever done of the mounds, every one of the survey maps that we could find, and a lot of it was never published before. In fact, we even found a mound that was never documented by the State Historical Society that was in Increase Lapham's personal journal. So we really delved into a lot of this and brought it all together. So it's very little, say, original research, but there was a lot of historic material out there from these surveys, but it had, really most of it had never come to light. The other thing we included also was the modern LIDAR imagery of the existing mounds and any of the mounds that really still show themselves as good images. We have those LIDAR images in there. And also, to Kurt's credit, by using LIDAR, he discovered 8 previously completely unknown mound sites in Dodge County on top of it.
And I want to ask about the LIDAR, but I also wanted to comment that one of the really cool things for me in going through the book, there's some color photographs of some of the mounds, but I really enjoyed seeing, oh my gosh, here are photos of Increase Lapham's original drawings, which I thought was really cool to look at. And then some of, obviously, his comments and so on.
170-year-old maps that he did. And as I said, much of this has never been published before. And so, yeah, it was really nice to put all of that together into one site, into one volume. And what we came up with is a conservative count of 1,079 mounds known in Dodge County.
Alone.
And there is others that there are at least some suggestion and inferences and notes that indicate there were probably another 200-300 or more. And I think the other real value of the book is the fact that we're lucky that these things were surveyed and documented when they were, because the vast majority are gone. All we have is a historic record. And it's really brings the landscape to life when you drive around, you stand, and now you're just looking at, say, a housing development or a cornfield or something. It's like, here, somebody mapped these mounds for us, and this was one of those sacred sites from way back then that stood here.
You have a photo in the book of a mound that looks to be about 10 feet away from a house, a little round mound.
Oh, yeah. That's the little conical that remains in the city of Horicon on somebody's front lawn. And at the cover of the book, we actually have Increase Lapham's map of his survey of the city of Horicon. He mapped out almost 90 mounds in the area. His map includes about 70. There were more off of there. So he mapped that in October of 1851. By 1892, when T.H. Lewis came through, he said they were all gone already. And I think that's what really stood out to us, why this was a good cover photo, because it's some of the most elaborate mound collection I've ever seen anywhere. They're incredibly unique, and they've been lost.
Kurt Sampson and Bill Volkert, our guests today. They are the authors of the book, The Indian Mounds of the Horicon Marsh and Upper Rock River, encompassing in Dodge County. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trita LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the book, The Indian Mounds of the Horicon Marsh and Upper Rock River, with the authors, Kurt Sampson and Bill Volkert. Great to have them with us. And certainly, if you want to join in with a question or a comment, I hope you will, at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Many of these mounds are burial mounds, but what do we find, what can be found inside a mound typically?
Well, you know, burials.
Burials.
And, you know, there's different, there, in effigy mounds, they don't contain anything but burials. They previous mound building complexes in the early and middle woodland, in some cases, interred their dead with grave goods, mostly utilitarian items like pottery or stone knives or projectile points and things like that. But for whatever reason, when they start building the effigy mounds about 1,500 years ago or so, they got away from interring people with any kind of grave goods. But there are a couple of different types of burials that occur. One would be a cremation burial that was done right on the spot when they were constructing the mound. And also bundle burials, which implies that these people may have died before the mound construction, and they were placed up on a scaffolding or in a tree. bones collected and then brought to a mound site at a specific time when people were regathering to do ritualism.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I hadn't thought of, and Kurt brought this to light, is that it also depends on how they treated the body depending on what time of year they died.
That's right. Well,
we get a harsh winter. You can't move dirt when the ground is frozen. So that's where they may have had then that scaffold decomposing of the body and waiting till spring. Mm-hmm. Whereas you die right in the middle of summer, you can move dirt, you can do something, have your ceremony at that time of year. So it's kind of a seasonal activity.
And I was kind of taken that in some of the mounds, there were sort of stratifications of different. So describe that a bit. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, you know, interestingly, one of the only ethnographic accounts that we have of any Native American that described what they knew about the construction of mounds, believe it or not, comes right from the History of Dodge County to 1880 book, which is at the Dodge County Historical Society. And in the 1840s, the early Euro-American settlers were asking Native American medicine man, Ho-Chunk medicine man, what he knew about mounds, and his name was Wiscopos. And he stated that when he was very young that the people that built the mounds would go into smaller hunter-gatherer groups in the winter months. And then when resources were more plentiful in the spring, they would regather into larger groups and oftentimes would gather at mound site locations where everybody would bring the deceased, and that they also scraped up soil from their winter encampments and brought them in deerskin bags to the mound site, and everybody contributed to the construction of a mound. Now, there are instances during the archaeological excavations that occurred mostly in the 1920s by Will McCurdin from the Milwaukee Public Museum that showed that in some cases they were also incorporating other soils that were not from the immediate area, things like hematite or red ochre that they would grind down into a powder, muck or marl from lake or stream bottoms in the area, and in some cases even pure white sand. And one of the ideas about that is that these obviously meant something important into the ritualism of creating the mound itself.
That was really interesting. Seth in Baraboo has a question for you. Let's go there.
Yes, hi. Thanks for having me on. I have a question in regards to the current day initiatives for mound preservation and education. So recently the DNR just came out with a objectives, goals, alternatives document for the Central Sandhills region for over 60 different public properties, state parks, state natural areas. And one of the things that kind of shocked me was they used the term mounds a total 12 times in that near 300-page document. And out of those 12 times, the one time that it's used is in reference to the mounds or the burial mounds, the sacred indigenous mounds. And one of the things that was very broad in terms of their objectives, goals, was they don't really acknowledge in detail about what they're going to do in terms of education, preservation, or maintenance strategies for these sacred mounds. And so with the public comment going until November 2nd, obviously, you know, one of the big things in today's scene for both public archaeology and professional archaeology is advocation for mounds preservation education. So I'm just wondering if there's been any talks and conversations with both DNR stakeholders, employees, staff, as well as, you know, recognized indigenous tribes and peoples in trying to get better strategies involved.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say that what they're doing is, this is, of course, the land management master regional master plan for those properties. So they're really looking at the DNR management. They're acknowledging that they have these cultural resources on their land, but the actual protection of that comes under the Burial Mound Preservation Act with the State Historical Society. So there has to be coordination, but this is, of course, a DNR plan resource management with at least some acknowledgement of the cultural resource. I'll let Kurt talk a little more about
Burial
Mound.
Yeah, you know, the DNR in the state of Wisconsin is the single largest landowner of Native American burial mound sites in the state. And as you know, I run an organization that's also called the Effigy Mounds Initiative, which also does mound care management around the state, where I work with private and public landowners that have mound sites on their property, and we try to give them information about best care practices. And I also organize crews where we go out and we care for mounds where we take off all the invasive woody vegetation off the top of the mounds. Our most current project is working with the Dodge County Parks Department and Nitschke Mounds County Park in Burnett Township between Horicon and Beaver Dam. And so over the last 15 plus years or so, there's been a lot of talk between a lot of different organizations, DNR, private entities that are looking for information about best care practices. The DNR in Wisconsin back, I think it was in 1985, first produced a management, a cultural resources management plan that they've been working off of. And through the years, they've tweaked that plan and updated it. And the plan that I follow is very much similar to what they, you know, we feed off of their plan. And it's basically just, you know, making sure that the mounds are protected and first of all, and that that no harm comes to them for, by any kind of management issue. And then just going out there, and we normally work in the winter months when the ground is frozen so it doesn't impact the mound. And basically it's just taking off any large trees or woody vegetation that would impact the mound itself from its integrity of how it was constructed. If large trees are on the mounds and they fall over eventually, that uproots the mound. So we take those off. And that's pretty much what we've been doing.
Thank you very much for calling, Seth. Appreciate it. Let's go to Katie in Fond du Lac. Katie, hi.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if there might be artifacts buried beneath some of these developed lands, like cornfields and sites that a person may still have access to that may be recovered from these developed sites. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know around Horicon Marsh, there was a lot of collectors there. That's just simply because you had a very large human population living around that marsh for thousands of years. I think the main places they find are former village sites where you had people living on the same land. One location I always like to cite, and this was a fellow who lived along the Rock River, just north of the or east of the marsh, as the river flowed toward Horicon Marsh. He had this vast collection of the spear points, projectile points, arrowheads that he found. And he said almost all of it came from a little knoll, a little three-acre area. And I always like to point that out because I keep thinking, imagine yourself living on that same land 1,000 years ago without all the modern development. Where would you camp? You're going to be up high and dry, right on the river, access to the marsh. He had a collection of artifacts that spanned from 9,000 years ago right up to historic times. Everybody camped in the same place over and over again. So, yeah, you can find some things kind of randomly scattered, but where people were there in large numbers and time and again went back to the same places, that's where you're going to find the artifacts. And, of course, the thing to keep in mind now is that most of that's private land. And same with the effigy mounds that we've highlighted. Most of these are still today on private land, and they are protected under the Burial Mounds Preservation Act, so we cannot molest or disturb the mound. And you also have to respect the private land trespass laws. So, yes, we did give the location of these mounds, but, again, without landowner permission, you don't want to go on there out of respect.
And there are some good places where you can go. Is it Kinji Park? Or
Well, in the immediate region of where our book focuses, there's one county park called Nitschke Mounds County Park, which is run by the Dodge County Parks Department. There's also our newest state park, Lizard Mound State Park, which is just north of West Bend. It was just reverted back to a state park. Those two parks really are flagship parks that really highlight the effigy mound construction. There's also our newest National Historic Landmark in Baraboo, the Man Mound, which a lot of people are familiar with, that was preserved in a county park and was owned dually by the Wisconsin Archaeological Society and the Sauk County Historical Society. And then if you go to many state parks, Devil's Lake, Wyalusing, whatever, there's lots of parks, state parks that have mounds that you can readily see.
Even State Fair Park in Milwaukee.
Yeah, yeah, even State Fair Park, yeah.
And right on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus.
That's right.
I'm right here, yes.
Really good examples of that. As you were talking, I was thinking about my own youth when we lived on a farm, and one of the woods We'd go berry picking there, and my mother, over time, would find while she was berry picking a arrowhead or a spearhead.
Sure. Yeah.
And there's a mound. There's a round. I'm sure it's a round mound that's sort of on the top of that hill. And I don't know that it's ever been identified.
It's possibly
full of trees. And I often wondered about whether or not to ask about it or report it or have someone look at it, what would, you know, what they might
do. If you ever suspect that you have a prehistoric site on your property, you should contact the Office of the State Archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historic Society. And as Bill mentioned before, we have a brand new state archaeologist, Dr. Amy Roseborough, and the people in her office can direct you to what you can do about that.
Mark in Sussex has something for us. Hi, Mark.
There was a classic statement, I forget who it was, that you do not own or the earth. You belong to the earth. The earth does not belong to you.
Yeah. Mark, thanks. And you're nodding, Kurt. Well, actually, I think Bill was.
That was Chief Seattle. And it's a famous quote that he said, and it's absolutely correct. We don't own the earth. The earth belongs to all of us. And I think what he may have been trying to get at is, you know, about why we wrote the book. And in this day and age, I will just say that the effigy mounds now are part of our collective cultural heritage, and it's really up to all of us to help preserve them now. And there are some people that felt that maybe Bill and I shouldn't have written this book because we're not indigenous, we're not Native American people. But you know, we know that these magnificent effigy mounds that are so few now, you know, over 90% of them have been destroyed. And so that's one of the reasons why we felt that it was important to document these mounds in this book.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind just how fragile they are. It's just simply a mound of dirt. Now, some of these are hundreds of feet long. They're spectacular in their shape and form. And to me, they're more than just a sacred burial site. These are monuments. These are ancient monuments that have been left. And the other thing that also stood out to me, and while we're doing the research, was looking at Dr. Bruder's survey of an eagle mound, which is unfortunately, he surveyed in 1951, and that's been lost and destroyed. But as he was measuring and surveying it, he said that the perfection in terms of its symmetry and layout was such that as he was, again, measuring what they did, it wasn't just moving a pile of dirt and somebody standing there, put a little here, a little there. There was essentially an architect. There was a deliberate design and very carefully laid out. So this was not somewhat haphazard. As I say, these are pieces of art. These are monuments, and this is part of our cultural resources.
We have a number of people emailing in. Let's see. Karen emailed when she grew up. They knew that there were pointed trees around. They were pointing trees around mounds. Most were tipped over. She thinks she had one on her Harvard land near Wisconsin Avenue, wondering if they're still around. But I'm not sure.
She's referring to trail marker trees, and these are trees that are purposefully bent down and tied to the ground, so they will grow with a point in a certain direction and point make the tree look a little odd because when it grows the branch grows upwards or whatever. And
well, there's very few of those that remain because they were done prior to European settlement. So we're looking at trees that have to be more than 200, 250 years old. So there's not a lot of those standing. And some of them also seem to be perhaps a little questionable because if you have a young tree growing and something falls into it, it will regrow and try to reach around it. So you have to look at the context of where it lies in the landscape. Yeah. But we do know that they were doing that to mark trails. But unfortunately, some of these are just so ancient of trees that not a lot of them remain today.
And I will say that I was when that came up, I was thinking about trails. And one thing that you do have in the book is you talk about some of the ancient trails, because those trails were can still identify, apparently.
Yeah, during the 1830s, when the first surveyors came into Dodge County, They were often marking, not only where ancient works were on these early 1830s surveying maps, but they were also marking where the well-worn Native American trails ran across the countryside. And there was an individual named Neuenschwander who went back through the old maps and reconstructed where those trails went through Dodge County in several different directions. And coincidentally, many of those ancient trails pass right by effigy mountain sites.
Yeah. Well, and on top of that, a lot of those are nowadays followed by our highways. Now, of course, the highway engineer likes to go with, you know, straight lines and round things. But County Z on the northeast corner of the marsh, County A from Horicon toward Fox Lake. Highway 33 was the Sauk Trail, which became the Decorah Road, which became our state highway. So we're driving on a lot of those. And, of course, Highway 151, the military road, that was a major one from Winnebago down here to Madison.
Lisa from Sparta emailed. She had read a research paper that detailed cairn-like beehive structures around the Red Wing, Minnesota area, and wonders if there are similar structures that existed in Wisconsin.
I don't really know a lot about those, to be honest with you. I am familiar with the ones that she's talking about in Minnesota. I don't think that they were very prevalent in Wisconsin for whatever reason. But yeah, they did have some rock cairn burials that I know that. There's a lot of literature in a lot of the old county books that talk about how early Euro-American settlers did encounter these structures on the landscape, and a lot of times they were torn down, just like the mounds were to, you know, for farm field and stuff. But I think that they're not very well documented from what I understand in Wisconsin, and they have been documented around the Red Wing, Minnesota area, but I can't talk to that.
Brian wonders if you had any idea about the experience of might have been of building a mound. What might have it been like to gather and go through the process? You did talk about that a little bit. But.
Well, you know, one of the things that's really apparent when you go to any effigy mound site or any mound site is you don't see depressions in the ground close to mounds where it looked like they took dirt from over here and placed it over here. And so what we think they were doing was taking things like scapula hose and just lightly scraping the surface near the mound site and they were using basket loads of dirt basically to scrape this dirt in there, and there were more than likely communal projects that integrated people into their belief systems, and then of course we have that ethnographic account of them bringing soils from other areas. So it was a labor-intensive thing. And how do you get people to do that? Well, it's because it was intimately entwined into their religious belief system.
Wow.
Kurt tried to summarize a number of the theories, ideas about the meaning of the mounds and what was really going into it. But the problem is that we're just looking at what we see today as evidence, and we're removed by more than 1,000 years of what people were thinking, practicing, believing, and doing back then. So there is that cultural bias and a bit of that whole lost time to try to look back at what was going on. But I don't think there's any way that you can stand at a mound site and not just ponder and wonder and be inspired by what you're seeing.
Jill emailed us and said you mentioned the Eagle Mound that was destroyed in the 50s, 1950s. Mm-hmm. How could that have happened where they can...
Well, Wisconsin, unfortunately, has more mounds than any other state in the entire United States, but we were one of the last states to get a Burial Sites Protection Act, and that was signed into law by Governor Thompson back in 1985-86. So prior to that, if you were a landowner, you could destroy mounds on your property for quote-unquote progress or farming or whatever it would be. And, you know, now the mounds are protected with the Burial Sites Protection Act. You can't build anything within 10 feet of them. And archaeologists no longer excavate mounds. And, you know, part of that is that we already had 170-plus years of mound site excavations. We know what's in those mounds and what their general purpose is, so we don't really need to do that anymore. And besides, now we have non-invasive techniques of ground penetrating radar and things like that. But unfortunately, when the early Euro-American settlers came in, they were concerned mostly with survival and farming. And so a lot of, you know, more than 90% of the mounds were destroyed. At one time, we estimate that there were probably somewhere near 30,000 effigy mounds in the southern third of Wisconsin alone. Now only roughly 3,300 of them exist. So, you know, archaeological resources are non-renewable. Once they're destroyed, they're gone forever. And that's why preserving these mounds and documenting them in a book like ours is really important.
Yeah. And earlier, I want to get back to LIDAR because you have LIDAR photos in the book. And to explain what LIDAR is.
Well, LIDAR is light detection ranging. And we have a good friend named Doug Norgord, who's a cartographer here in Madison, that helped us produce better slope and hillshade LIDAR images. LIDAR works very similar to Google Earth, but where you can zoom in on a particular portion of land. But with that light detection ranging laser, it strips away the vegetation, and what you're left with is just the topography of the landscape. So if you have an effigy mound shape that's incorporated into that topography, those effigy mound shapes pop right out. LIDAR was developed in the 1970s during the Apollo missions to the moon to map the surface of the moon. And then about maybe 15 to 20 years ago, it was made available to the general public where park and land use departments in counties use it to produce more accurate plat maps and things today.
I wonder, before we go any further, I want to make sure people know how they can get copies of the book, The Indian Mounds of the Horicon Marsh and Upper Rock River.
Well, for those who live in near Beaver Dam, Kurt has them at the Dodge County Historical Society. For people who would like to order one by mail, I have it posted on my website, billvolkert.com, and Kurt certainly has it as well.
We have a PayPal account, too, which is under my email, which is just Kurt with a K, K-U-R-T, Sampson, S-A-M-P-S-O-N, 1968 at gmail.com. So Kurt Sampson, 1968 at gmail.com. They can also send us checks. And another place they can go is on the Effigy Mounds Initiative Facebook page. And there are several posts on there with our addresses on there where people can send us check or money orders for the book as well.
Yeah.
Larry, if I could just finish with one of my favorite quotes that we have here. I think this really sums up an impression of the mounds. And this is in our book. And it says, "Very few understand what perfection there was originally in these colossal figures, carved out of the earth and covered with a green sward. They seem to move under one's feet. Here we have in the earth molds animal figures which are lifelike and true to nature as any artist can make them. And yet, we are careless in reference to their preservation, and their destruction is inevitable. As works of art and pictures of the native fauna, we think these figures are invaluable, and we make our plea that they be preserved." Written by Stephen Peet, 1890.
Well, and here we are in 2023, and we got a brand new book out, and it's called The Indian Mounds of the Horicon Marsh and Upper Rock River. Kurt Sampson, Bill Volker, thanks a lot for, in the first place, doing the work for this book. It's a fascinating read, I hope a lot of people get to read the book and look through it. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Real pleasure. Kurt Sampson is director and curator of the Dodge County Historical Society in Beaver Dam, a certified archaeologist as well. Bill Volker, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at the Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and of course, he was working right among those mounds that are part of the book. Well, it was fun talking with them, and I hope you have a chance to look at the book. Another book that'll be coming out is the Breeding Bird Atlas for Wisconsin. And Nick Anich is back with us to talk about the survey, DNR conservation biologist. And Nick is next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.